the scope of the paper has changed, really rather reduced because of time limits. The other thing I must apologise about is that I'm showing you quite a lot of images, but where the images of are of rather larger documents, the quality is poor, because at the very last moment, my A3 scanner failed on me, and so I had to do some very fast photographing, and they all look a bit crumpled and shadowy, but that only applies to the large ones, so I don't think you... I hope it won't worry you, just overlook it. Sorry about that, and I've got my watch here to keep the time. 3 months after Robert Barker opened his first London Panorama in 3 months after Robert Barker opened his first London Panorama, in Paris, the Bastille was stormed and the French Revolution was definitively launched. By the time he opened his permanent rotunda in Leicester Square in 1793, that's what some of you will see on Thursday, the French royal family had been guillotined and the Reign of Terror had begun. Britain was already looking with anxiety at these alarming political events on the other side of the Channel, and for much of the next 20 years, for most of the panorama's first quarter century, in fact, Britain and France were to be at war. The war may have been costly in terms of economy and lives, but war makes rattling good reading, and it provided thrilling and also very informative subjects for the pioneers of panorama painting. Throughout the Franco-British conflicts, panoramas offered the London and at the same time the Parisian public, although we're not going to deal with Paris this morning, a vivid documentary record of the land and sea battles and of the countries where wars were being waged. Today I want to show images, the plans, of some of the French war panoramas, and to explore a little how the panorama painters developed their styles and techniques of documentary presentation in facing the challenges of depicting the war. Because of the time limits, I shall mostly concentrate on naval subjects, and mostly, almost exclusively, on the panoramas of Robert Barker, and in one case, his son and rival over in the Strand. The fundamental problem of battle painting was to comprehend in a single static painting the geographic range and the chronology of often of many hours of a battle. Topography was easy, warfare was a problem. Well, today we're in a town that was a vital link in Britain's defence. The great natural harbour of Plymouth Sound had made it throughout Britain's history a vital centre for the navy. Sir Francis Drake set sail from here in 1588 to confront the Spanish Armada. 32 years later, a more modest expedition, the Pilgrim Fathers, embarked in the Mayflower to settle in North America. Plymouth shipyards provided a considerable part of Britain's great shipping force. Well, in the summer of 1797, with the war already raging, Robert Barker opened his panorama of Plymouth. Now, it's taken from Mount Edgecombe, and Jonathan Gesetner and I went out last night to try to find Mount Edgecombe. We couldn't, but I've found it. And if you look on your map, you wouldn't naturally find Mount Edgecombe, though it may well be that your boat will take you there this evening, because we're up here, and if you go down to the water, you land on the water there, but in fact, Mount Edgecombe is just off your map over there. So that is where the view was taken. Given the moment at which it appeared, it was, to judge from the plan at least, these plans, of course, were handed out to visitors at the... when you went to the... panorama, you were handed one of these paper plans and you could look around and you could spot everything as marked on the plan. Given the moment at which it appeared, it was very surprising. The view is taken, as I say, from the top of Mount Edgecombe, and it shows intimately, got to find this little forward knob, yeah, all the topographical features of the area. It shows the dockyard, and it shows the shipyard, and Lord Edgecombe's military battery. But the really strange thing is that there is not a single ship in view. Now, we might be tempted to wonder if this was only regarded as an outline guide and that shipping was depicted in the panorama itself. I don't think that's possible, because if you had ships, you'd want them to be identified. So for the moment, we can consider the Plymouth panorama as one of Barker's war documentaries. It was clearly otherwise with one of the very first panoramas in Leicester Square. In 1793, Barker presented his view of the Grand Fleet at Spithead in the year 1791. That ran from May 1793 to April 1794. Now, these periodic royal reviews of the Navy at Spithead, close to Portsmouth, are not merely ceremonial. They have always had a strong propagandist, political motive, either to impress some dangerous visiting foreign potentate or to declare preparedness for war, sabre-rattling. Obviously, sabre-rattling was the purpose of the 1791 review, and by 1793, when the panorama offered a repeat performance in miniature, its propaganda value was even greater. Well, from 1796 onwards, Barker and his rivals chronicled every important stage of the war. And the first panorama I want to talk about was presented by Barker in 1797 and celebrated an engagement that had taken place 2 years earlier. On 23rd of June 1795, Admiral Lord Bridport, with his flag in the 100-gun Queen Charlotte, came upon a French flotilla and set off in pursuit, rather slowly because there wasn't any wind. The engagement took place just off the Isle of Île-de-Croix, and though Bridport captured three ships, the action was really quite inconclusive, and Bridport was much criticised in the Navy for his failure to win a more decisive victory. However, the British public, hungry for any success over the French, hailed the Battle of Groix as a great victory. And in the general euphoria, Bridport was promoted at the age of 70 to be Vice Admiral of England. And 2 years later, as I say, it was still popular enough for Barker to make his panorama. Practically speaking, Barker did not attempt to show any particular progress of the battle. He really showed a rather formal review of the ships of both sides and left it to the viewer to create the narrative. To assist the viewer in this do-it-yourself history-making, he was supplied with three plans showing three different stages of the action. Plan one shows the position just before 6 a.m. when the advanced British ships have already engaged the enemy. Plan two... Have we gone to plan two? Yeah, we're at plan two. Plan two shows the situation at 6:20 when the French ship Formidable has caught fire and surrendered, and plan three shows the situation at about 8:30 when the Royal George cut off the retreat of the Tigre, which struck her colours, and the battle ended. Not a great battle, but there we are. And that is the Tigre, the last boat to surrender. And that is the admiralship. So Barker's next major naval panorama was the Battle of the Nile. This was very much a night battle. The action began at 6:30 in the evening and went on until the last two surviving French ships limped off at 11 a.m. in the morning. Despite the 16 hours duration, it did not give many chronological problems because it was a very static battle. Got to find my book. A very static battle. The ships of both sides simply anchored and then just pounded one another with their cannon. So Barker was able to put his ships into position and show them dramatically surrounded with cannon smoke. He's taken the license to depict at least one dramatic moment from the battle. At 9:10... Oh! We've gone on to the hero of the battle. At 9:10, at 9:10, the French battleship Lorient, with 120 guns, caught fire and exploded, dramatically showering both fleets with flaming debris. Not that the British fleet was unscathed. The Bellerophon of 74 guns looks in pretty bad shape. However, it was the Battle of the Nile that definitively launched Horatio Nelson, whose portrait came on a bit too early, as a national hero. From now on, he was the Beckham of his day. And his next engagement was to contribute greatly to the legend. The Battle of Copenhagen was fought on April the 1st, 1801, and lasted for some 4 hours, during which the Norwegian-Danish forces lost somewhere around 2,000 men. This was, by the way, a very, very ugly action initiated by the British, who feared adverse trade effects from the Treaty of Neutrality, which the Scandinavian powers had signed with the Russian. And the battle also established one of the great Nelsonian legends. He was under the command, his commander-in-chief was Sir Hyde Parker, and Sir Hyde Parker believed that Nelson was in trouble and so ordered him to withdraw. And it was on this occasion that Nelson put his telescope to his blind eye so that he could not read the signal, and he said to the bystanders, "Sometimes I am entitled to be blind." Well, the battle came to a close when Nelson offered a truce to the Danish king, who, somewhat surprised, accepted it. Again, it was a fairly static battle. The Scandinavian troops, the ships stood in line, and Nelson had a strategy of sailing up the line and engaging, disarming each ship in turn. So the circle, as you'll see there, is neatly divided by little bars, little markers, into exact halves, on one of which is the Danish line of defence, and on the other, the British line of attack. Barker quite consciously represented interesting elements of the battle which were not in any way contemporaneous. So we have in the panorama the burning of the Admiral's ship, the Dannebrog, and we have the little rowing boat that carried the flag of truce, which effected the end of the battle. That's Nelson's ship. Oh, that is an envelope. Now, that is because Barker's panorama of the Battle of Copenhagen inspired the first known discussion of this temporal problem raised by battle panoramas. Fascinatingly, the issue was stated not by a painter, but by the hero of the battle himself, Horatio Nelson. Nelson accepted an invitation from Barker to inspect the panorama before it was open to the public. And the next day, Mr. Barker received the letter in this nice envelope. Mr. Barker, panorama. Nelson's written Mr. Barker, and somebody else has written Panorama Leicester Square. And here is the letter which is inside it. And Nelson's script is rather hard to read, and so I've transcribed it for you. He writes, "I have acceded to your request and seen the picture which you intend to exhibit of the Battle of Copenhagen, and making due allowances for the alteration of the positions of many of the ships in the space of 1 hour and a half, which time I consider the picture to embrace, I have no scruple to say that I consider it the most correct picture of any event I have ever seen. There could be no higher praise, but it is interesting that Nelson actually did recognize the definite space of time that embraced the events depicted." So coming to his biggest show and biggest challenge, the Battle of Trafalgar, Barker had still not solved the problem of giving a sense of the continuity of action. Again, you feel you have very much a do-it-yourself fleet. You have representations of all the boats, but you're also offered two plans in the middle. You are offered two alternative plans. Plan number one shows the English fleet bearing down on the enemy's line and was taken on board the Victory. Plan number two was made on board the Euryalus. And Trafalgar, of course, was a particular problem because it was, on the one hand, it was a famous and decisive victory, but it also marked the death of the great national hero, Nelson. And Barker dramatizes this. That's a part of the fleet, and that's, as a matter of fact, I'm not sure what, I can't see what that is, but there we are. That's the Royal Sovereign, I think, yes. And there we are, there we have the, I think, the Victory, and Nelson is already lying wounded there. And specifically, he shows the little rowing boat which Lieutenant Hills took in order to carry the melancholy news of Nelson's injury to Lord Collingwood aboard the Royal Sovereign, which we just saw. There's the little rowing boat. And if the panorama is to be believed, that little boat had to pass a group of French frigates and a couple of battleships in order to get to the Royal Sovereign. Well, Trafalgar was Barker's last depiction of a naval battle during the Napoleonic Wars. From this time, his panoramas were concerned with land battles. This is something I added rather late. This is just another view of Waterloo. This is from a panorama which the Royal Naval, the National Maritime Museum have, which was done by William Heath around 1820, and which in their catalogue of Nelson and Napoleon, the National Maritime Museum said was copied from Barker's panorama, which it most certainly was not. It's a completely original one, but it's quite pretty. So that was Trafalgar was the last naval panorama for Barker, and from this time his panoramas were concerned with land battles like Badajoz, Vittoria, Paris, and of course the big one, Waterloo, which was so successful it enabled Barker to retire from the business. By this time, the panorama painters had become extremely conscious of the time question. Of Waterloo, we're very fortunate because we have two different representations of the Leicester Square panorama. That is the normal circular plan. As you see, he put an awful lot of detail into it, as it's described in those notes. But in 1852, when the Duke of Wellington died, it was revived, and he then did another version of the plan. So we can come at that plan in two different ways, come at that panorama in two different ways, which gives us a lot of information about it. And we also have, of course, the plan of the rival Waterloo down at the Strand. As I say, the panorama painters have now become very conscious of the time question, and both panoramas, both Leicester Square and the Strand, chose the very same period of time. That is the evening between 7 and 8, when the poor weather had been succeeded by late sunshine, and in any case, Britain and her allies were definitively routing the French. In the Barker's Waterloo panorama, you're also very conscious of the propaganda element here, because there is the very great difference between the treatment of Wellington and Napoleon. Now, you see, Wellington there is shown with his staff. That's from the 1816 plan of the Barker panorama. There it is from the 1852 plan of the Barker panorama. And there's Wellington and his staff in the Strand panorama. On the other hand, Napoleon Bonaparte is never actually depicted in person. In fact, the way that he's shown is quite derisory. If you see that little spot, number 12, right at the top, which appears again, there it is, I think, as number 51 in the circular panorama. That is described as scaffold and wood where Bonaparte remained the early part of the day. And he does appear again. You can see, I think, you can see the number 48. Can you see the number 48 against nothing? And that is described as Bonaparte with his telescope, viewing the fate of the Imperial Guards the moment before his flight. How demeaning. And at the Strand it was even worse, because at the Strand you have to look for the number 7, which is practically in the middle, and the description below that says, above this figure, Bonaparte and his staff are represented leaving the field. Well, I can't see anything above the figure, so I think they've really fled. They were very insulting to poor Napoleon. I now want to just talk briefly about one panorama which is not by Parker, and it's not even of a battle. It's about a battle that never was. In 1804, Napoleon marshalled his Grande Armée, the Grande Armée Anglaise, the army that was going to undertake the invasion of England in Boulogne. 50,000 troops, 58 ships of the line. And in 1804, an Englishman, John Thomas Serres, who was the marine painter to the king, was permitted to go to Boulogne and paint this panorama of the Grande Armée in Boulogne. It was quite an interesting panorama because the viewing platform, which you see at the bottom, was represented the stern gallery of the Leopard, the Rear Admiral's flagship. There it is, closer up. And it's very unclear, but it seems that the panorama was actually viewed not from the from the middle, but from the side. And I think that there was a perspective to help you in this. Now, you might think it rather strange that Napoleon would allow an Englishman to go over and paint his preparations for the invasion. You may think it even stranger that this panorama, 48 feet high, opened in Spring Gardens and ran in London for 3 years. The enemy preparing to invade you. A very strange subject. And it's quite alarming. There are the troops all in their tents on the back, there are the boats. I actually believe that the reason for this was that Napoleon was very, very good at PR and publicity. And I suspect that he knew this invasion was never going to happen, because to get 50,000 troops across under the noses of the British Navy was a pretty impossible situation. And so my suspicion is he let Serres do this. He let Serres exhibit it just as a bit of real saber rattling, a saber that he was probably never going to use. There's one very charming aspect of this, and that is that Mr. Serres painted himself painting the panorama. There he is. You can see Mr. Serres. It's rather hard. I think he's not the man in the Admiral's hat, but the man just on the left. It looks to be a pretty rough and rocky job to do a panorama. So we really close on the portrait of a panoramist at work. But there is one footnote that I'd like to add to this, because Mr. Serres, the English Mr. Serres, who eventually died in prison, I may say, was not the only foreigner in Boulogne at this time. There was an American expatriate who, for the moment, I will call Mr. X. And Mr. X had presented Napoleon with a plan for the invasion. His plan was a piece of extraordinary mechanization. It involved towing huge pontoons with the troops and arms on, towing them by steamboat. It also involved the use of submarines and of torpedoes. None of it was terribly practical, because the steamboats would only go 3 miles an hour, and the torpedoes, there's no way to shoot them. You had to take the submarines under the boats and tow the torpedo into place. However, this was a very elaborate plan that Mr. X had worked on for a long time, and he endeavoured to present it to Napoleon. It was obstructed by Napoleon's staff, and Napoleon only saw it very late. Napoleon, when he saw it, was very, very regretful. He said, "This would have won me the fort." He loved this plan. The British also knew about this plan, and they got their agents in touch with Mr. X, and Mr. X was made an offer he could not refuse, a huge bribe, to come over to England and bring his invasion plans over to England. For this he was paid what was then the enormous sum of £10,000 plus a salary of £200 a month, plus a promise, which I don't know if it was ever fulfilled, of another £40,000. So Mr. X abandoned Napoleon and came to England. The American historian David Whittet Thompson, who's documented all this incident, writes rather satirically, "What a pity the British bribed Mr. X to leave France. He might well have guided Napoleon Bonaparte straight into the jaws of ruin." So who was Mr. X? Well, Mr. X was a rather well-known industrial spy and patents thief called Robert Fulton. And 5 years before he was planning the invasion of Britain, Robert Fulton had for once paid decent good money for the rights to exploit in France Barker's patent for the panorama. So life and art connect and imitate. Thank you.